Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to what is essentially the last Rugby World Cup podcast from Talking Rugby Union. We're going to discuss a bit of England's pretty heartbreaking loss on Saturday morning when they lost 12 points to 32 to the Springboks in Yokohama. And we're also going to talk a bit about kind of another big news story, I suppose, in rugby, in the world of English rugby in particular, club rugby, in terms of Saracens, their fine and points deduction, and kind of just our overarching feelings and emotions around that, as well as kind of a more professional journalistic approach to it, of course. So yeah, some people might be wondering, what is Talking Rugby Union? Simply put, Talking Rugby Union is a free online platform where you can digest as much rugby union content that you want, and I know I've already said it, but for free, which seems to be the big thing that people talk to me about when I tell them kind of what I do, is that they don't want to be paying for content because, you know, not everyone wants to spend money on that kind of thing. And Talking Rugby Union is the place to go if you don't want to be paying for content, you don't want to be finding all these paywalls that are knocking around at the minute. And yes, that's what Talking Rugby Union is. Yeah, I've already said this is the final podcast of the Rugby World Cup period. It's been a great 6 weeks for Talking Rugby Union, where I think we've smashed some records that have been previously set. And yeah, thank you very much to everyone that has enjoyed our content over the six or seven week period of that we've been producing content specifically surrounding the Rugby World Cup. And this is kind of the end of it. So I suppose we could probably say 8 weeks, 2 months, Chris, that we've been doing Rugby World Cups.
Yeah, no, it's we got some figures through last night, didn't we, Joe? Yeah, really pleasing to see that so many people have enjoyed the content, especially the stuff we've been doing in terms of the social media and the Instagrams, podcasts, all that stuff. Mm. So yeah, it's been a bit of a busy one, Joe, but the dust has finally settled, and I think we lied on the last podcast and said that would be the preview for the final, would be our last one. Yeah. But here we are again, churning out content. So yeah, it's been a great sort of 6 weeks, but unfortunately for us, it didn't have the ending most of us would have liked. So
yeah,
I'm blaming you, Joe, because you said last week at Rugby X that England would win the World Cup, and we were like, a few of us were like, no, you know, don't want to tempt fate, so it's your fault England haven't won the World Cup.
Not English, mate.
No, but you still said it.
Well, you know, to be fair, I think a lot of people were in the same mindset and maybe just didn't want to admit it. I said it
to tempt fate, that's why
I said it, and I was wrong, because South Africa did win the Rugby World Cup in pretty heartbreaking fashion, actually. Tries from Makazole Mapimpi and Cheslin Kolbe really putting the icing on the cake of South Africa's 32 points to 12 victory in Yokohama. Chris, what were you thinking when you were watching that game?
That the game was slowly but surely getting away from England. I mean, we're on obviously WhatsApp between the TRU team, and we were saying a lot of things after 10 minutes that the game was sort of getting away from them. They were forcing a lot of things, and I think for me it just looked like the occasion got to them a lot. I think there was a stage where South Africa had started really well, and England then tried to play out their own behind the post, really, and trying to get out. And it's like England haven't done that for the last 8-9 weeks or so.
Well, you contrast that to the game that they played against New Zealand, where essentially if they're in their own half, they kick it as deep as they could into the opposition half, and then they play the rugby there when they got the ball back. Whereas in this game, I will remember this play for probably the rest of my life. Billy Vunipola picks it from the base of the scrum, completely fine, that's normal, and then flings it out of the back door to George Ford, who's really not expecting that pass, because you would expect a number 8 to take it into contact to try and get out of the 22 for the box kick to then be delivered to get England in the opposition's half. And that was symptomatic of what England were trying to do that day. It seemed like they just didn't know what they wanted to do.
There was, I think it was the first half, Ben Youngs as well, is, you know, trying to look for the first receiver. We've seen it a lot throughout the whole of the World Cup, how England carry so well. At Toji was, I think it was a Toji or Tuolangi, one of them was the first receiver, completely missed them, looked for Anthony Watson, and ball went over Watson's 30 head.
30 metre pass.
And it's like, Ben Youngs has played the majority of this World Cup campaign for England. We've never seen him or Willie Hines produce that sort of pass or that move, and it was sort of England have forgotten all the hard work that he'd done, which was massively frustrating. It's like, great point you make there, Joe, because against New Zealand they did everything spot on, and it wasn't flashy. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't as if, oh, this is a new bit of tactic that England have come up with. It was sensible play, and that's what I think eluded them, whereas the flip side with South Africa, they used their strengths well and completely overwhelmed England.
Well, the thing is, the week leading up to the Rugby World Cup, Chris, we've talked about this interview on the last podcast with Joel Stransky, and of course the audio from that podcast, from that interview, was played on the podcast. He said, I think I may be getting some of the wording wrong, he said South Africa play to how the rules are blown. So how the rules are interpreted by referees. Now, Jerome Garr says, I don't want to blame a referee for a bad English performance, but the thing is, what you could tell from South Africa, you could often hear ref at rucks, at whatever. And did South Africa maybe get in the heads of Jerome Garr says that day?
I think they used it to their advantage really well. I think you can look at it definitely from your point of view, Joe, where I'm sat here as an England fan thinking, my God, they're in the referee's face every time, give it a rest. But from a sort of take a step back and look at sort of, I think in any sport, you can influence the referee and talk it. I love talking about football, but I've noticed recently as a captain in for Liverpool that Jordan Henderson does that quite a lot now. He goes up to the referee and tries to speak to him. And I thought South Africa used that very, very well. And I think that's why they did. Of course, they had the power at scrum time, but I think there were scrums which were going their way. And I think maybe if England had said something to the referee, maybe if your Makos or your Dan Coles said, hang on a minute, ref, they're as bad as us, it might have had an effect. But I think they used it perfectly to an advantage, and every single at scrum time it was a South African penalty, which is exactly where they based a lot of the success on it during this World Cup.
And let's talk about that scrum. Now, England's scrum was going to be entirely different at the start of the game if it hadn't been for a pretty nasty knockout blow to Carl Sinclair from, was it
Atoji's
hip?
Yeah, it was.
So Carl Sinclair within 3 minutes is laid out on the ground, arms in the air, which is indicative of a concussion and a not a serious head injury, but a head injury that would take him out of the game without the need for a head injury assessment. So, Carl Sinclair, surely one of the leading lights at tight head of the whole tournament, not just for England.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way he played against Australia was fantastic. His performance, I think, against New Zealand was brilliant as well. And I think to see him go down after 3 minutes was such a blow for England, because he's been so, so influential. And I think as soon as he went off, if South Africa needed another boost at scrum time, they got one. And straight away, I think it was maybe 30 seconds, a minute after Sinclair got off.
It was as a result. That penalty.
South Africa could go win a penalty straight away. And I think it was on Mako's side, actually, that they won it that time.
I think it was Tendai Matsuwarira that put Dan Cole to the cleaners straight away. I don't think Dan Cole... Firstly, obviously, he wasn't expecting beyond that early on. But then the thing is, you're thinking, oh, we're bringing on a 90-odd cap tight head prop. And you think, oh, he's going to deal with someone that's not too much his junior, really. I'm not going to say it again.
I think Cole comes into the game. He's not properly warmed. I know it's only 3 minutes in, but he's not properly warmed up. He's not properly in maybe the game mode Sinclair might have been in. But I still think both sides, you know, whether they were... you know, overwhelmed or not, South Africa. I just think they just dominated that when they needed to, and they probably did target Cole as soon as Sinclair come off. But for England's perspective, such a blow to see him go off.
It was pretty gutting, actually, fairly early on, and to be fair, England had given away a penalty right at the start of the game that Pollard missed, and then after that, giving away the penalty following that Pollard kicked, and then in between all that, Sinclair had come off because of the head injury. It already felt like it wasn't England's day. Because Sinclair, I don't feel, was too emotional. It didn't feel like he ran out the line too much or anything like that. But the thing is, it did feel like it was an emotional, maybe unready England side.
It was like sort of a catalyst to think, well, this is the first major problem of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
And then it's sort of events sort of slowly unfolded with, like you say, sort of what you say about Vunipola trying to fling a pass out the back door, Young's is overthrown pass. It was just those sort of things that kept going and going. And I think there was a stage where, I think it was the first half, where England did actually say, right, let's go through the phases, and only came away with 3 points.
When they went through about 20-odd phases?
Yeah, they went through about 20-odd phases, and you really hoped they would...
That was the first half, yeah.
And that was the first half, and that's when you sort of thought... from an England fan perspective, hang on a minute, they're going back to what they've been good at, and it's about trying to break down this South African defence, but we know how difficult it is to go straight through South Africa. Mm. But I totally agree, Joe, that sort of Sinclair moment could easily be a turning point, even though it's 3 minutes into the game.
Well, that's the thing, you mentioned that 25 phase period, and the thing is, that was the only time in the game, and that was in the first half, that was the only time in the game that England played like they did against New Zealand, and they couldn't come away with any points. And maybe that South African defence was symptomatic of the way the game was going to go, because they just weren't giving anything up. They were amped for it, and probably quite rightfully Sir Kalisa was the man lifting the trophy at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think you can have no complaints. It wasn't as if, you know, a poor referee decision had cost England, or it was like a horrendous mistake that opened the door for South Africa. Mm. It was the better team won. You can have absolutely no complaints. I don't think you can have any complaints in terms of the way the semi-finals went as well. The better teams won on the day, and South Africa thoroughly deserved to be World Cup champions. I mean, they've had an incredible year. I think everyone started to stand up and take notice of them after the Rugby Championship. You know, getting the draw against New Zealand and winning that game, and then even though they did lose to New Zealand in the pool stages, they just regrouped. They didn't let that affect them that much, and they deserved to be lifting a trophy, but more so in the final, because everyone had talked about England going there, and if they produce anything near what they did against New Zealand, they'd win the trophy. And they didn't. South Africa got the basics right, and that was the sort of the end of it, really, in terms of England's hopes.
Yeah, and both their tries coming from wingers in that second half. The Mpimpi try was the inside pass from the outside centre. What happened? I can't even remember what happened. So Mpimpi kicks it through right foot, and then it lands in hands, and then he nonchalantly passes the ball back outside to his winger to score a try. Some lovely stuff coming out about that winger. I didn't realise the past that he had. His mother passed away, his brother and sister passed away, and the only family he's really got now is rugby. So great story there already. And then Cheslin Colby scores a pretty well-class try.
Yeah, Colby-esque try, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was another one to put in his locker.
I mean, with the Mpimpi try, it was sort of like England's hopes were then. If there were any hopes left, that was it.
Did you feel like that try was coming?
I don't think it was coming, but it was like you knew if South Africa were to score the next try, that would be the game over. It wasn't as if England were like, I don't think England would be able to recover from it. And I thought from there it was too much of an ask for England to come back. And I think it was a big turning point for the shift in momentum in the game. If England had any hopes, they were completely over at that point. And going into sort of, I can't remember what minute it scored. It might have been with maybe 15 minutes to go, potentially, or
maybe less.
You thought that was it, game done and dusted. And in a World Cup final, which, you know, we'd hope would have been tight and going in England's favour, it just wasn't the case. And it was a South African 80-minute performance, which was just pretty much faultless throughout.
And as ever, things have come out after the thing about England with their medals.
Who's asked, really?
That's, yeah, exactly. And to be fair, I said,
I didn't actually see it.
I saw it and I was like, well, it's pretty understandable. You've just lost the World Cup final. It might be the only time you actually ever get the opportunity to be in that position. I mean, people like Dan Cole, he's never going to be in that position again. So I could be pretty understandable if I'd understand either way if we kept or got rid of his. The thing is, and then comparisons have come out to where you don't see Olympians complaining about silver medals.
Well, that's not the same.
But it's not the same, is it?
Not the same at all. Silver medal in the Olympics is a bit different to a runners-up. It's not even a silver medal, is it? The World Cup's a runners-up medal.
Just a runners-up medal.
I don't know. I didn't see the end of the New Zealand game, but I'm not sure if they were presented bronze medals. I presume they were.
They were.
But are you telling me they're going to be keeping them? All Blacks.
Not the All Blacks.
Sonny Bill Williams is going to be heading to rugby league with a bronze medal in his
back
pocket.
He gave his away quite quickly, as I remember.
I'm pretty sure he gave his World Cup one away. It's four years ago.
He did, yeah, to a kid.
It's not a silver medal, is it? It's a runners-up medal. No one wants the runners-up medal. And I think if you ask any sportsman or woman who's finished as a runner-up, not a silver medalist Olympian, which is not quite the same in my view, any sport, whether they've still got their runners-up medal knocking around the house, it'd be probably in the loft somewhere if they've still got it.
I'd have quite honestly lobbed mine in the sea.
It's ridiculous, and people are complaining about it. Just like, you know, you're making a story out of nothing. That you've just seen South Africa win the World Cup. Fair enough, everyone's disappointed with England not winning it, but it's been a great World Cup. It's ended in a wonderful story with South Africa winning it, which is, for me personally, has only really come to light over the last sort of 3 or 4 weeks ago, sort of the struggles that were going on over in South Africa
definitely.
And then people talk about whether England players are wearing the medals or not. I mean, it's a story which doesn't need to get any more coverage than it does, but it has to. Obviously we're mentioning it because everyone else has lost their heads on Twitter about it, so I think people just need to calm down.
Well, yeah, and of course we would obviously love to congratulate South Africa on winning the Rugby World Cup. It's once every 4 years. They've not won one in 12 years. It's the third time that they've won the Webb Ellis and taken it home. And, you know, in the lead up to it, we realised kind of the wider ramifications that it would have them winning the tournament. And one of those things being, to be quite blunt about it, a black captain lifting the Rugby World Cup trophy, mm-hmm. and then being able to take it home to kind of unite a nation 24 years on from when that first happened.
Yeah, I think, you know, reading, I sort of knew sort of, right, actually, yes, there was quite a lot of problems going on in South Africa, but the Joel Skronsky interview, Joe, that you did, it was sort of made it even more of a story going into the game, and you heard sort of more of the South, I don't know why, but for me, you saw more of the South African players talk about the stories, you know.
Yeah.
See, Khaleesi was, you know, talking about his story. You mentioned Mpimpi. Was it Mpimpi's story?
Mpimpi, yeah.
Yeah, story. And it was, you know, it's just, you know, it's an incredible feat that they'd be able to do. Not just, I mean, there's two sides of it, really. One is the political side of it, and, you know, the fact that a country probably needed this to bring them all together. But the other side is the rugby side of it, whereas South Africa were on the knees. You know, well, they're not on the knees, but they were really, really struggling maybe 18 months ago. So it's a brilliant story that Rassie Erasmus has taken this team with Siya Kolisi as captain to win the Rugby World Cup. But as you say, Joe, it's from a wider point of view, it's an unbelievable story and something which I think's fascinating to hear that the past World Cup winning captains of South Africa have said this is probably the biggest one they've achieved because of what's been going on in the home nation. So it's a fantastic story, and it's an unforgettable moment, I'd say, and one of those pictures, you know, that will be etched in World Cup history.
Yeah, of course. And rather amazingly, some of those South African players are going to be playing in the Barbars game against Fiji at Twickenham in a few weeks, probably still carrying on some of the Barbarians' traditions all the way up to it.
I'm just having a look at some of the pictures that greeted the South African players.
Oh, the videos, like, of all the airports, absolutely
rammed. Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable.
There's a picture somewhere of Cobus Reinach's Twitter, if you can get it up in front
I'll
of you.
I'll have a quick look there.
There's a brilliant picture of Willie LaRue asleep at a table.
Brilliant. Brilliant. It's phenomenal. It has absolutely phenomenal. It just shows how much, you know, the support that the nation needed is there now from this rugby success, and hopefully has a massive effect on them.
And of course we're going to see some of those the World Cup winning players plying their trade in both the Premiership and the top 14, so we'll see them in the Champions Cup and the Premiership, but maybe not Vincent Cock because he plays for Saracens. And we're going to get to that, but I want to ask Chris, top five moments of the World Cup. Well, it doesn't have to be top five, just two or three.
You know, I'd say because we were obviously designated pools, Joe, in terms of, you know, there was probably a lot more focus on maybe pool B for you than it was for me.
Yeah, definitely.
I think for one of the things that comes out from the pools, well, two of the things that come out from the pool stages for me were definitely Wales' win over Australia. I think that was possibly maybe other than England's performance against New Zealand in the semi-finals for me was probably the game in the tournament, potentially.
Uruguay beating Fiji?
I think that Wales Australia game was absolutely fantastic.
It was a great performance from Wales, wasn't it?
It was a brilliant performance from Wales. They showed everything. You know, they played well first half, then Australia came back into it and had to show immense character, and all the talk before the tournament was about how big that pool game would be alongside, you know, New Zealand against Africa. So for me, that was a brilliant sort of moment for me. Like you said, Fiji Uruguay was worth the early start that morning. It was an amazing, I think the whole narrative around it, you know, Uruguay versus Fiji, that, you know, Fiji came into the game needing to get a result after defeat to Australia, and a very quite a decent performance from Fiji, and then obviously Uruguay coming into the game still searching for that elusive World Cup win for the first time since 2003, I think it was.
Phenomenal.
And then where the game was actually played, you know, affected massively by the tsunami.
Yeah.
The whole narrative behind it was just a wonderful, wonderful, made it such a wonderful occasion. And for New Uruguay to go on and get the win and play the way they did has to be one of the standout moments for me, Joe. And I'd say another pool moment for me was Japan beating Ireland. I think that was just incredible.
I'm trying to work out if I enjoyed the Japan-Ireland or the Japan-Scotland more.
But both games, I think I enjoyed watching the Japan-Scotland one more. I think there was a lot more riding on it at the time. I think that's probably why.
Because of Typhoon Haggis.
And the way, yeah, exactly, and the way it sort of came about to that. So, yeah, those three definitely standout moments for me in the pool stages. And then, I mean, the knockout stages, like I said, England's performance against New Zealand was magnificent. It was
amazing.
So, yeah, those are probably the handful picks of standout moments, I'd say.
I'm going to say one off the field, one that sticks in my mind, which was the Canadian players helping to clean up to make sure that people get to fan parks after the typhoon. That was pretty good, especially as their game had been cancelled earlier that day as well. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think what else. There's some pretty good moments. Josh Larson apologising after his red card against South Africa, the Canadian lock.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good moment. And then, of course, I think top of the list is Sia Khaleesi lifting that World Cup trophy.
Yeah, absolutely. Most definitely.
Got to be.
Most definitely, yeah. It's like I said before, Joe, it's, you know, you'll go through the archives of Rugby World Cup wins and you'll see, you know, Richie McCaw lifting a trophy, Francois Pienaar lifting a trophy on that famous day in 1995. But
Is he the first black captain who lifted it full stop?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
I think so.
That's amazing. That's a story in itself.
It makes it, you know, historic in itself. So yeah, that will be definitely one of the standout moments for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So, Chris, that segment is the end of the Rugby World Cup coverage, especially on podcasts.
Yeah, shame.
So there we go. That's something.
All done and dusted for another 4 years.
Which is why I've titled the next subheading as the reason I've called it "Back to Reality," back to club rugby.
Back to club rugby, Joe.
Which is arguably where we excel. And there's only one place to start with this, and that is Saracen's massive fine and massive points deduction for breaching salary cap rules.
Yeah, I think if you were putting this together at 9 o'clock yesterday morning, Joe, it would have been on a standard Premiership roundup. It would have been sort of Northampton Saints have flown out the blocks. What about Bath under the new leadership there, and how they're going to fare. But this is just completely one of the biggest stories, if not the biggest story in English rugby club history. Staggering.
It's amazing.
I think a lot of people come out and said, why is it taking so long for it to come to this stage? But the fine is, like you said, £5.3 million for short, because there's a lot of numbers after that. But the thing that, 35 points to the European
huge
reigning English domestic champions is huge, and obviously they're going to review everything that's happened, and that may not make anything official until sort of the new year. But scary. For now, Saracens will have an asterisk apparently next to their name on 9 points, with the possibility of being reduced to -24 if they were going to happen this
week. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because they have they've lobbied against
they haven't appealed, have they? I don't think they've appealed. It's just
they have a 14-day period grace period before they actually have to either accept the points deduction and fine, or basically go against it. So if they were to have just taken the points deduction, which in a lot of people's heads they have, they would be on -26 points at the foot of the Premiership table, which is pretty damning. Already?
Yeah. Because I think Premiership Rugby did actually originally put them on -24 before the review started. My maths is wrong.
26.
And you looked at it and thought, wow, hang on a minute, let's work this out. So they've got 19 Premiership games left.
So
they would have to possibly win 10 of them, maybe, by bonus points, would you say? Or
that'd be 50 points, yeah.
50 points, maybe. But someone said that, I saw a tweet yesterday, I think, to the question you posed on Twitter, Joe, about bringing us your opinions or whatever.
Oh, yeah, I need to write that.
That was, someone said, oh, Newcastle went down with 31, I think it was.
It was a lot, yeah.
So that's why I think if they were to get 10 bonus point wins, just for an example, they may be able to stay up. And I think Saracens are more than capable of doing that.
Oh, easily.
But yeah, it's huge. You look at all these stars who are going to come back from the World Cup, and as much as it was a disappointment that England didn't win, you've got to think that all these players will still be, you know, in such a confident mood after having such a successful World Cup, and Saracens may have used that to their advantage. And I think we have seen sort of at the start of this season, they have sort of wanted to get those internationals back as quickly as possible in terms of some of the grinding out the victories they have done, especially at the weekend with the late penalty to get the win. I can't remember who they played, but Manhoven Apollo kicked a late penalty.
Good penalty as well, actually.
But that's the thing, they want these players coming back, and now they're in a situation, you know, Owen Farrell's going to be coming back from Japan, and he's thinking, oh, this is not what I want to be going
Sell into Sharks next season.
Team for. It's massive. It's huge. It's going to be, I know the last, it's been a long time coming, but I still think this period will be talked about for definitely over the next 2-3 months, because it won't go away. And a lot of people have come out and said, well, they should be punished further by getting expelled to the league. We've seen on Twitter, we've seen a few people say, well, they should be stripped of the titles that they've won. And Penny, I tweeted yesterday saying, you've got to think about what's going through the minds of your Exeters and people like that. It's a massive story, and it will surely rumble on, Joe.
Yeah, I've done a couple of tweets. One was a bit tongue in cheek, which was, imagine being the person that has to unstitch all the stars from their jerseys.
Yeah.
But I think the main thing is, how do they react to this? How does the club conduct itself following this? What happens with players that are deemed to be over the salary cap? How do they do that? Where does this 5.3 million come from? Because Nigel Ray is already operating at a loss with the rugby club. The business is doing all right, but surely there would have to be cuts. So this affects people financially with their job security.
Yeah, it does.
It's massive. And it's one of it's after that original Leicester side in the early 2000s / late 90s. This is the best club side we've ever seen in rugby.
Yeah, the most dominant over since since 2011. They've really, really been dominant, haven't they?
Yeah.
I think Mark Ashcroft put in our WhatsApp group yesterday an article which John Kingston had written for The Independent, and it was an interesting one, that his viewpoint was, well, they made cuts when they needed to. It was like first come, first serve. So Ugo Monier was one of the star players at that time. Let's get him tied down to a contract. Yeah. But then I think it was Dave Strettle was there, and he wasn't one of the first players to pipe up and say, or vice versa, the club didn't go to him and say, we want you to stay, and he went to Saracens. And they sort of, what John's point was, that Quinn's played by the rules and were affected by that in terms of the success, where his point was Saracens haven't done that.
Yeah.
And now they're paying the price for it.
Well, you see players like Santiago Cordero, Exeter Chiefs, who Chiefs wanted to keep. They made no secret of that. And he has to leave because he wanted too much money, and the salary cap was basically preventing him from getting the money that he probably deserved. Mm. And especially when you see that Chiefs are bringing the likes of Stuart Hogg and, you know, players like that to try and drive them forward. When you see Santiago Cordero going to Bordeaux because of that reason, it does make you feel that it's not an even playing field, especially when you look at a Saracens team that's got the likes, well, that will have the likes of Elliot Daly.
With Daly, I don't want to be misquoted here, but I swear I read that he's been taking a pay cut.
Yeah, no, that is true. But then the thing is,
you're absolutely right.
The reason that Saracens are taking the massive knock on this is because of the back payments made to players that are setting up businesses. I don't think any of them are shell businesses. I don't think any of them are shells at all. But the financial help that the players were getting on top of their wages being paid by the same man, I think that's where there's a bit of a blurred line.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's probably why this will probably all iron itself out, won't it, over the next couple of months or so. But yeah, you know, that's the thing with businesses, it's people's, you know, livelihood as well as playing professional rugby. So it's such a big story, and, you know, I think everyone may have been looking at the game they've got on Saturday afternoon at Gloucester and thinking that'd be an absolutely brilliant game, but
Jesus,
it's going to be absolutely dominated. And if, you know, if Saracens, you know, don't turn up or have a bad day at the office, the stories will continue to grow. And I think they're not present at the Champions Cup launch today, are they?
No, which has basically launched an investigation by the European, the EPCR.
The reigning world reigning European champions, aren't they?
They were so good in Newcastle as well.
Exactly. And it's just, you know, it's not probably what Saracens needed. You know, they've not made a blistering start to the season. I mean, 9 points from a possible 15 is no bad start, but from Saracens' perspective, they were, you know, to lose to Northampton on the opening day, edged the way. I think it was London Irish, wasn't it? They played at the weekend, edged the way past London Irish.
I think it was actually, yeah.
You know, it's obviously they're missing all those players, like we just said before, and they, you know, they're getting by, but you know, it's not what they needed. And yeah, it'd be massively interesting, like you say, Joe, to how they will react to this on Saturday.
Did you see the Alex Sanderson interview a couple of weeks ago? I mean, just before the Prem started, like that last weekend of Prem Cup, he said, and we might have to do a bit of research on this and pause the recording briefly, but my understanding is that he said the England players, this might have been on BT Sport or something like that, I don't know how you'd be able to find it, he said that the international players, because of the rules that were brought in as a result of the RPA negotiations, that England and other international players would only be available for 7 regulation games this season.
This season?
Yeah, because of, like, do you remember at the start of last season, the RPA did a thing about they have to have enforced breaks after playing international rugby for extended periods of time. So my understanding is, because of that and the Six Nations, that I don't know if this is just Prem games or European games as well, but Saracens will only have like the likes of Ofara, Maritoji, blah, 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 available for 7 already formatted games this season.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's another thing they probably don't need, isn't it?
No.
I'm just trying to find where he said this.
I remember seeing it on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I found it really interesting, but I didn't make a note of it.
Saracens had 8 players
playing this weekend.
Playing for England.
And then Vincent Cock on top of that.
Yeah, and Vincent Cock on top of that, like you say. So, it's just, I'm going to have to probably have a research after it, to be fair, Joe. But yeah, you are right in terms of some of the senior players' businesses and coaching staff businesses as well that are obviously going to be under a bit of pressure now to see what the outcome of this is.
Yeah, of course. And it's not the prettiest story in rugby at the minute. But, you know, this is what happens. This is what happens. These things happen in sport, and everyone learns from it. So in the future, things will be much better. So that's maybe the way we kind of have to top off that topic. Elsewhere in the Premiership, Saints are top.
Yeah, very good start, haven't they?
Yeah.
Very, very good start to the season, Joe. I mean, it's nice to sort of talk about the rugby, and maybe even Saints are quite happy with the fact that their fantastic start to the season hasn't been talked about too much. I mean, we were there, weren't we, in the summer?
Yes.
Speaking to Chris Boyd, and you do get the sense that they wanted to take the next step this season after such a great second half of last year, really. A mixture of these young players and the experienced lads, and they've made an absolute flying start. I mean, to beat Saracens on the opening day is something that will have given them a huge confidence boost.
At Saracens as well.
At Saracens, exactly. But 3 from 3, the only side to do that. So far, 14 points from a possible 15.
Wow.
They're playing some really nice stuff. I think I didn't see the game on Friday against Quins, but I saw a video with Niavoro's try. It was Rory Hutchinson.
The man is
brilliant pass. And we'll be seeing a very similar carbon copy, I think, of Niavoro swatting defenders out of his way to score tries this season. But yeah, they've got a great sort of harmony down there now in Northampton in terms of those young players coming through, and Chris Boyd has got everyone singing off the same hymn sheet. So fantastic start for them, and they'll be hoping that continues, because you know, with the likes of, you know, your big clubs maybe missing some of the key internationals, Northampton themselves had maybe Ludlam from England. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else who they were missing.
Well, the thing is that Owen Franks has only just arrived.
Yeah,
not involved with the All Blacks, but obviously was given a bit of a grace period by Chris Boyd and the coaching staff there. I'm trying to think about, yeah, you are right. Not many had selected.
When you look at, you know,
because Hutchinson was selected for the pre-World Cup games, then wasn't selected by Gregor Townsend. So that must have been a massive plus going into Premiership.
I think Chris said that to us, didn't he, when he was there, that we've not got as many as everyone else going away, and they've taken full advantage of that. And looking ahead to this weekend, Saturday afternoon, away to Bath, bottom of the table. Ooh. Bath. They'll be hoping to make that 4 wins out of 4, Joe, won't they? But great start to the season for them. They fully deserve to be where they are as well.
Yeah, and currently the Bears are in joint second place, we'll say, with Gloucester on 10 points apiece.
Yeah, I definitely watched the game. I think you saw the highlights from their first game against Bath. They were brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Nathan Hughes,
they would have been so disappointed last weekend to have not backed that up. I can't remember. Was it Wasps? No, the Wasps played Bath last weekend.
Yeah, Wasps played Bath and Wasps won. I know some of it was the game, I think.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, let me just say you, who they played last week. Yeah, it was Quinns. They went away to Quinns.
Everyone's playing Quinns.
Yeah, everyone went away to Quinns. Lost the game. Obviously did play that badly, 22-17.
Yeah.
Pick up a point, happy days, move away from a side that finished very, very close to the top four last year. But then they backed it up against Sale on Friday night. You know, they got another good win at Ashton Gate, and it's somewhere they were so good at last season.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
You know, we sort of got the sense from that opening night win, against Bath, that their sort of shifting goals and aims had taken place, I think. In terms of the way, sort of, I think Austin Healey made a brilliant point in commentary. He said the way sort of Pat Lamb was talking about Bristol this year, last year he was excited. You know, they were just happy to be playing the rugby. This year, they're sort of like, well, actually, no, we want to take that next step to maybe challenge for the top four and obviously initially aim for Champions Cup rugby. So, yeah, all going well for the Bristol Bears at the moment.
Well, that's the thing. I did interview Charles Pietau, didn't I, just before the Barbarians game, and he basically was audibly so gutted by the fact they didn't get top six. So I think this season, they're really up for it. Exeter also on 9 points with Saracens asterisk at the minute. Sale on 7. I think Sale, now that Sarries may not be in the mix as much as they were, probably quite enthusiastic.
Yeah, on Sale, yeah, I think the first day of the season, disappointed second half against Gloucester, like really disappointed that they didn't manage to build on what was a decent first half display. And then the frustration, I think, came out. Josh Beaumont told us last week, you know, the frustration really came out against London Irish, and to get that win was right, let's build on that. And last year, they, you know, they went to Bristol and had the really good chance to win the game. I think the Clerk missed a penalty towards the end of the game and could have won it at Bristol. So they were going there thinking, you know, we tried there last year to get a result, why not do it again? And I think even Sale tweeted after the game, it wasn't a particularly good display from them last Friday. So Wasps on Friday night, Joe, I know you'll be going down to the AJ Bell.
Yes, I will. First time there. Yeah.
Again, you know, the home game as well, that Sale notoriously very, very good on a Friday night at the AJ Bell, and they'll be hoping for something similar. But Wasps will be going into the game with a bit more confidence after some decent displays in the last couple of weeks. So, but I think you're right, though. You've got to look at these clubs who are thinking, well, Saracens may have had this knock and they maybe could be on the minus points. And every club now has got to take that chance to sneak into the top four, because Saracens have lived in the top four for the last few years.
Yeah. And just to kind of cap things off, we're going to talk a bit about the women's internationals that are happening, starting this weekend with England against France in Clermont-Auvergne. So very kind of, it's going to be cold there, isn't it? It's a mountain.
Yeah, it's going to be cold. Middle of November. Very, very cold.
I feel very bad for them now. But I don't think they fly till Friday, actually, because we have a phone call scheduled with Simon Middleton.
Yeah, we're going to be jumping on a conference call with Simon Middleton
tomorrow.
You know, we did some good stuff with England's women's team when they're over in the USA during the summer.
Yes, you did.
Great to be getting Simon's thoughts ahead of a decent autumn for him, because it's been a great year for England. I know, you know, they were maybe disappointed not to come away with a title win in the Super Series, but, you know, Simon said that he was very much, this was still a learning process. It was testing them against the best of the best in the world, which they haven't done. They obviously did the Six Nations. So this is another part of the development process after what's been a brilliant year for them. And really exciting times. Obviously, they'll have the best player in the women's game playing for them.
Emily
Scarrett. So brilliant achievement for her. But, you know, I'm just looking at the squad in front of me now, Joe.
It's a good squad.
You've got Heather Kerr, who we spoke to, who was at Durham University last year playing in the Bucks final. She's got a chance again. She was over in America during the summer. She's got a chance again to play. And you've got some great names. Obviously, TRU favourite Sarah Beckett is in the mix again. Great to see her involved. But it's a really strong team. And they're obviously up against France first, aren't they, Joe? And I think their biggest game of the Six Nations was that game. Was it at Sandy Park or was it Doncaster? I think it was. And they played.
Yeah, it was Doncaster, because they played Italy at Sandy Park.
Yeah, and that was sort of the biggest sort of test. You know, obviously, it was like a month and a bit into the contract's been announced and the full-time players, but they completely and utterly annihilated the then Grand Slam champions. So great game to start. France will be wanting their own back, but England will want to be putting another marker down for the growth of this game, the growth of the team and the women's game.
Yeah, and you've got it in front of you, so I could actually have this wrong. Then they play France in Exeter?
Yeah, they've got France in Exeter next Saturday, the 16th.
So the following week.
Yeah, the 16th of November, then the 23rd, they are in Bedford against Italy. All of them, well, 3 o'clock kickoff that one, and the two France games are 3:10 kickoff.
Oh, is it 3 o'clock? Because I'm going, I need to remember that.
Yeah, 3 o'clock. 3 o'clock.
I will forget otherwise.
But yeah, both games against France, 10:10 kickoff, and on Sky Sports as well.
Oh, very social times for the French audiences as well. So yeah, best of luck to England's women for those upcoming games. Of course, hopefully I'll be catching up with a couple of people as the weeks go by, as we try and increase our coverage of women's rugby now that we actually are free of Rugby World Cup duties. Yeah, so kind of just to top this all off now, thank you very much for everyone who has enjoyed our content over this Rugby World Cup period. We don't often get the chance to say thank you, but at the end of the day, this is mine and Chris's jobs, and without people going on the website, we don't get paid fundamentally.
Yeah, I think also, Joe, obviously great, fantastic, everyone's listened to the coverage, but in terms of the TRU team, I think everyone who's been a part of it's put in a massive, massive effort.
Yeah.
You know, from our journalists, Gary Heatley and Ben Mercer, produced some great stuff for us during the pool stages. Gary, obviously, great columns with Scott Lawson, which is massive. Obviously, Max Goffich, who probably doesn't like the name mentioned, but he's great, fantastic with sort of the creatives behind everything, and Max Ashcroft heading things up as well.
Yeah.
For us, he's been, you know, such a clear direction of where we wanted to go in the talk with the whole of the pool stage and stuff like that. And obviously his dad Mark's been a big influence for us as well, so everyone there deserves credit. Obviously Joe, the main head on the podcasts, I think between us two and the rest of the team, we've done a really good job of making it a bit different to your usual coverage, but I think everyone involved deserves a lot of credit for what we've done, and we thank everyone's efforts.
Yeah, and yeah, it's kind of a weird one, kind of topping off the World Cup like this, but we're going to be doing another podcast probably next week, so we'll probably be talking about the things that are happening in the club game, maybe talk a bit about your uni. Every now and then, I'm thinking.
Yeah, we definitely will just for Bucks, who are probably still alive and kicking next to not dominating, but they're doing really well. Durham are up there as well. They've made a good start to the season.
Leeds Beckett had a good start.
Leeds Beckett, yeah, they're doing well. Last year's finalists. University Rugby is going very well. Buck Super Rugby continues to produce some outstanding results. So more of that to come, I think, Joe.
Yeah, and I'm going to just kind of mention it. We're going to have a bit of a change in scenery starting next week. To make sure that we can all meet up more regularly, essentially, like that. So there's probably going to be more regular podcasts than there have been over this World Cup period, kind of one a week at least, probably. So we're really looking forward to kind of increasing podcast coverage as well. So if anyone would like to get in contact about potentially sponsoring the podcast, we have no fees set. So we, of course, would be happy to have a little bit of a negotiation with people about putting basically a bit of your branding on the podcast, and of course we're open to whatever, really. So please get in contact, email austinh@talkingrugbyunion.co.uk. And then also, actually, I have written this note and I nearly neglected to say it. When you subscribe, please leave a review and a rating, because that helps boost us up the charts, and not that we're really kind of aiming to be like number one or anything like that, but it's just nice to be a bit more visible on things like Apple Podcasts. And one thing I have to do probably Friday is get in contact with Spotify about getting the podcast put on there as well, which could be quite fun. You can follow Chris @C_Heal on Twitter and Instagram. I believe I've got that right, Chris.
Yep.
You can follow me @JoeHarvey34 on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. And you can follow Talking Rugby Union @TalkRugbyUnion on Twitter, @TalkingRugbyUnion on Instagram. Just type in Talking Rugby Union to Facebook and you'll find us basically at the top of your page. And then if you're into the business side of things, go on LinkedIn. We're on there as well. I checked the LinkedIn stats yesterday, actually. They were pretty good. Did I put them in group chat? I think I did.
Yeah, no, you did.
Unless I put them in the wrong group chat.
They were pretty... pretty impressive, weren't they?
So. Yeah, I'm not going to say anything specific because I still want to get let into England games. So that probably tells you everything you need to know about that. But yeah, thank you very much to listening to this Talking Rugby Union podcast. Myself and Chris have really enjoyed doing this one, actually. It's different being in each other's company once more. If we didn't mention that.
Rather than over the phone, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Thank you very much for listening to this Talking Rugby Union podcast. There'll be another podcast probably next Monday or Tuesday. And yeah, I'm sure you'll hear us next time.